the hearsay argument respectfully has no merit. And then if this court holds as we'd urge the court to hold that this was error, then I don't see any way around the court finding that this error was also was harmful to the defendant under Rule 44A of the Texas Rules of Appellate Procedure. It was constitutional error, and that requires reversal, as this court well knows, unless the court determines beyond a reasonable doubt that it didn't contribute to the conviction or punishment. And in McDaniel, following the Van Arsdale test, the court said that you first assume that the damaging potential of the desired cross-examination was fully recognized, and then review it in connection with five prongs, which I'll go into. And then finally, in consideration of both of those two prongs, if the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. So in this case, we would consider or assume that the evidence of the complainant planning to putting aside funds and planning to divorce my client was in evidence. Then you have the five factors, and the first is what the importance of the testimony to the state's case. This was the complaining witness. She's the one who was allegedly the victim of the assault. She is obviously, you know, the primary witness for the state, although there were her two children testified as well for the state, one of whom testified that he claimed that he witnessed a portion of the alleged assault. Nobody's testimony made or broke the case like the complainant's testimony did. The second through fourth prongs, again, go to, the cumulativeness of the testimony. Urge that it's not cumulative. This is different from the acts and events that occurred in this case. Secondly, as far as other evidence corroborating or contradicting the testimony of the witnesses on this issue, there wasn't any other testimony on this evidence. So there is nothing to corroborate or contradict this. And to the extent, the issue of the extent of a cross-examination that was otherwise allowed, our cross-examination at trial was limited in many respects. As I explained in the brief, the defendant attempted to cross-examine the complainant about areas like her previously taking my client's key, her previous assault on her daughter, a summary of the 40 times that she and my client met after the event, the date of this alleged event.
You're trying to say that was admissible, are you? Something that happened after the offense, after her allegations and her report to the police?
Well, I'm not really arguing its admissibility or inadmissibility, Your Honor, but rather that the cross-examination on various issues was, in fact, restricted and limited.
So is it your position that it was improperly limited by not letting the defense attorney ask about what she had done after these allegations were made?
If I have to answer the question, and I will. If I had to argue that, I would argue that it potentially was improperly excluded because that, again, would go to her credibility. So, in fact, the fact that she saw him the 40 times afterward, I do think would go to her credibility as testifying against him.
But you're not raising those restrictions of evidences as or exclusions as error?
No, Your Honor. I think I'd better, let's see. And then finally on the fifth factor would be that without impeaching the complaining witness's credibility on this issue, the state's case was relatively strong. I mean, if you have one eyewitness to an event like this, you have a case. The state had her, the complainant, her two children, and the officers who responded. So without being able to impeach her credibility, I think that the harm is very plain, and I think that if this court finds error, that it inevitably should also find that the error was harmful to my client.
Well, you run out of
No, because there are no annotations to the statute. So I could not find any case where it has been submitted as an instruction. But I would say that just because there is no case on it does not mean that if it does, if it meets the applicable test for being submitted as an instruction, shouldn't preclude it from being submitted as an instruction. In other words, if there's evidence to raise an instruction, any evidence, no matter how weak, impeached, contradicted, unimpeached, the law says that the trial court is obligated to instruct on such an issue if requested. It was properly requested. It was. Well, the only case I found that even alluded to 903 was the Kenny case, which is in my brief. And in Kenny, it said that the defendant was not entitled to the instruction under 903 because the defendant was not entitled to the greater instruction on protection of property, I believe. So in this case, though, we did get the self-defense instruction. So I think the converse would be true. Because we got the self-defense, we were also entitled, upon request, to the 903 instruction. And I see that my time is run.
It has. Thank you very much, and we'll hear from you again on the vote.
Yeah. Thank you, Your Honors.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Matthew Witten, and I'm here representing the state today. I will also confine my arguments today to the issues that counsel has already talked about, and will note, like counsel has, that the factual sufficiency point of error probably ought not to be addressed at this point in light of Brooks. As far as the evidentiary issue goes, there are four hurdles, as I see it, to appellant winning that issue. The first of all is that he's going to have to show that the evidence was admissible to go to bias or motive as far as their credibility on the stand, as far as that witness's credibility on the stand. The second is that if it does, it's still got to be admissible otherwise under the other rules of evidence and the other rules of admissibility. Third, even if it should have come in as far as that, the appellant's going to have to show that the trial court's ruling was outside the zone of reasonable disagreement. And even if it was, even if there was error, there's still the issue of whether its inadmission was harmful, and the state would submit that it's not. I'd remind the court that the abuse of discretion standard that we're under here requires the court to affirm under any applicable theory of law that could apply to the case. So in other words, the trial court judge's words are of some but little importance in deciding whether he decided the case correctly and decided this issue correctly. In other words, as long as there's anything in the record that could support his ruling, the court needs to affirm. One could say that his words were wrong, but as I pointed out in my brief, one could also say that what he was attempting to convey, that the evidence that appellant was attempting to get into with regard to these bank transactions could have been harassing or overly prejudicial or confused the issues. And so the question really is, was it within the zone of reasonable disagreement? To the extent that appellant can be said to have made a bill, so to speak, in this case, I would point out that it's roughly in two places. They're both in the third volume, roughly around 74 pages 74 through 79. This is a rough estimate where Ms. Moss was testifying. She was the complainant. And at that point, appellant's trial counsel elicited some testimony from her that approximately a year prior to the assault allegation in this case, that she had a separate account out of which she was paying some of their bills at appellant's behest because his ex-wife was trying to have the child support raised. that was the extent of this testimony that supposedly leads to a plan of divorce or something else, which I will get to in a minute. Regardless of whether there was a plan of divorce, this evidence should not have come in. Because specific instances of conduct are not admissible to impeach unless they go to bias or motive as far as the witness's credibility on the stand. We have a confusion of the issue in this case. The record is clear that that was not what the appellant was offering this testimony for at trial. Appellant's defensive theory in this case was to blame Ms. Moss, whether it was his self-defense, affirmative defense that he raised, or other methods of showing that Ms. Moss was maybe trying to bait him into an assault or something like that. But none of this evidence that he tried to get in got to the level of showing that. The other point where he was testifying was hearsay, because the only part where he talked about it, he said, well, Tina, who is Ms. Moss's sister, told me that Ms. Moss did X as far as these bank accounts. And so the state would submit that that is hearsay and not otherwise admissible. But the point being this, there's a disconnect between what appellant has raised, which is that he was attempting to show Ms. Moss's bias or motive as regards to testifying truthfully, versus what he was really offering it for under the record. And so you cannot say that the trial court applied the wrong relevancy test. The trial court applied the standard, more prejudicial than probative sort of test to determine relevancy here. It's one way of looking at this record. And the reason he applied it was because it was clear that appellant trial counsel was offering that evidence as part of his case to show that the assault didn't take place as the state had alleged. And so evidence of bank transactions just simply has almost no relevance, and it's certainly more prejudicial under that test. But even if we assume and give the appellant the benefit of the doubt that he was offering it to show bias or motive, it didn't get there. The bias, there is nothing in this proffered testimony that he attempted to get in that would show a plan of divorce. That's never mentioned. The only time it's mentioned is when appellant's counsel during opening statement told the jury he was going to bring him evidence along that line. And then, of course, it didn't come in. And there's nothing in the record that would show it. And, in fact, he told the judge when they were arguing over this point that he was intending to show a, quote, I think his words were flashpoint in their lives, a point where she was trying to get appellant to snap or something and either attack her or file divorce or something. And so the idea that Ms. Moss had some plan of divorce just isn't borne out in the record. And, in fact, the record affirmatively demonstrates that it was appellant who filed for divorce in the end. And so to that end, the trial court did make the right determination because the evidence just didn't go to bias or motive, and therefore a specific instance of conduct just is not admissible. To answer your question, Justice Gardner, the evidence was cumulative. Appellant, as far as impeaching Ms. Moss and attacking her credibility at trial, was allowed to testify at length about things that had gone on in their marriage. They had a decidedly rocky relationship. And also brought in, I believe it was five witnesses who testified that Ms. Moss had a poor reputation for truthfulness in the community. One of those witnesses even snuck into the jury that Ms. Moss had a Jekyll and Hyde personality. So to say that this other evidence from long ago that only tenuously could be said to have anything to do with an assault that happened a year later just would be totally cumulative and of very little relevance, would also have a tendency to confuse and distract the jury. And the state's case was strong with or without that evidence. If that evidence had come in, the state still had photographs that showed that the injuries Ms. Moss alleged to have happened did in fact happen. Had their two children in the home who said what they heard. You had three police officers who were able to interview all of these parties immediately after the assault occurred. And so the state had more than enough evidence whether or not this other testimony came in. And so it stretches reason to say that it might have been harmful. And I would just want to remind the court that under what the appellant says is the appropriate relevance test, once that trial court made the determination that that evidence would not aid the jury in appraising the credibility of the witnesses and assessing probative value to that testimony, then it was perfectly appropriate for the trial court to go ahead and apply the regular relevancy test. And that is that's what's borne out in the record here, and that's what happened. I'll move on to the jury charge issue now. Appellant also has several obstacles here. First, it's just not raised by the evidence. We have to give the term confinement its plain and ordinary meaning, and we have to give the statutory provision its plain and ordinary meaning. Even if you give that issue the benefit of the doubt, the appellant still has not shown that it was raised by the evidence and that he was entitled to a wholly separate instruction, like he's saying. Appellant wants a whole separate instruction on this issue of confinement, but it's not an affirmative defense listed in Chapter 9. And further, even if he had gotten the instruction, and I didn't really mention harm in my brief, but I just briefly want to mention it here, he couldn't have been harmed by it, because the way the confinement, Section 903, reads, and given its plain and ordinary meaning, a jury could not have found against him on self-defense, an instruction which he did get and which the jury did resolve against him, and then found for him on the confinement issue. It can't happen. Now, as far as the issue of what does confinement mean, I thought about this a lot, and there is no Texas case that would attach the meaning that appellant would want to give it. And it's important to remember that one of the ways that appellant was charged in the information was by grabbing Tammy Moss. And so this is a way that appellant is backdooring his way into another defense, because he wants to say that by grabbing Miss Moss, he was merely confining her. But when we talk about what confinement really means, that doesn't really make sense. The case I found, Edelman, it's in my brief, which is the only case I could find that discussed confinement at length, was really about it was a false imprisonment case. And in that case, it was clear that they were talking about somebody who had been confined. The charge was false imprisonment. And I think that being the only case tells us something. It tells us that confinement really does need to be given kind of a narrow definition and given its ordinary meaning. It's also not listed by Texas cases as one of the seven statutorily defined affirmative defenses. And so while it is true that a defendant ought to be given an instruction on any defensive issue that's raised by the evidence, which it wasn't here, the state doesn't concede that point, but it certainly doesn't mean that he would be entitled to a whole separate instruction, such as he has asked for here. And it is correct to say that a whole separate confinement instruction would have been subsumed by the self-defense instruction. It would lead to an absurd result to give two instructions, because the statute says confinement is justified where force is justified. In other words, they are two separate things. Confinement is not force. Force is not confinement. Confinement may be used in lieu of force, is what that statute really means. The best example I could think of is if somebody came to me and pointed a gun at my head, I would certainly have self-defense to grab him by the wrists and stop him from pointing that gun at my head. But I could just as easily run away, lock him in the room. That'd be confinement. If I grabbed him, that's force. That is self-defense. It is not confinement. Confinement would be leaving him in the room. And we've got to give it its plain and ordinary meaning. Just very quickly, I mentioned this. The jury found against the appellant on the self-defense instruction. By the very language of the statute, because confinement is justified only where force is justified, if the jury found that force was not justified, as they did here, then they cannot have found that confinement would have been justified, because confinement's only justified when force is justified. So, appellant, even if he had been given the instruction, the jury would have resolved that instruction, against him. And so we cannot say in any way that he was harmed by the lack of the instruction, even if we reached the point where we decided that confinement was raised by the evidence. The state would pray that this court affirm the trial court's judgment. And if there are no questions, I will sit down.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just responding as briefly as possible to the state's issues or points here today. First of all, I do want to say that there was a bill made in which the complainant was asked these questions about the bank account and her plans. And that started, counsel for the state, I think, said page 74, but actually began in volume 3 at page 72 to page 78 of the record. And that's where the testimony was offered from the complainant. It was also later offered through my client, the defendant, in volume 3 at 265 to 267. In the first instance, when the complaining witness was testifying, the defense attorney said that he needed to ask the complainant about the divorce planning that went into the issue. Now, I would certainly say here that that's not as precise as possible as it could have been, but at the same time, he certainly got into the issue in the questioning of the complainant, and to the extent there was any confusion as to why he wanted to present the evidence, i.e., to show her bias and motive to testify, that was cleared up when the defense counsel questioned my client outside the presence of the jury at that later juncture on page 265 to 267. So I just want the court to know that it was presented to the judge, the trial judge, in a form so that the trial judge knew the basis on which he was excluding that evidence. Also, the state says that we were not offering this evidence to show bias or motive. But, in fact, we were. And as I've said repeatedly here today in the brief and now in rebuttal, that's the precise reason to show these acts from a year leading up to the trial. In answer to your earlier question, Justice Gabriel, no, I did not present an issue on the exclusion of the 40 times because I'd be hard-pressed to find to, in good faith, make the argument that would only to bias and motive. It would be more in the nature of showing just bad acts. And so I chose not to select that as an issue for my brief. But conversely, I think this is a valid issue, that this planning, which was, again, wholly separate from the event that occurred in this case, showed that the complainant had a real motive to testify and accuse my client of this assault. And the fact that the other point that the state made about the complainant's sister would have testified, Tina, again, we didn't get there. All the defense attorney at trial was trying to do was question the complainant and my client on the issue, and would have asked the complainant herself, not her sister, did you set up a separate bank account? Were you planning on divorcing the defendant? Really quickly to the fourth issue, the jury charge instruction. I don't see the state didn't even reach harm because I would like to say they conceded harm, but obviously they did not. They argued today that it would be harmless. I don't see how it could be harmless when, again, whether this occurred was the whole issue in the case for the jury. To say that the jury found against my client on self-defense necessarily would have meant they would have found against my client on confinement as justifiable force is just, a fantasy, I would urge, because the jury is entitled, we're entitled as the defense to submit as many instructions that are supported by the evidence that the jury might find in our behalf. So I think that argument really fails, that because they found against us on self-defense, they would have necessarily found against us on confinement as justifiable force. Are there any other questions? Thank you very much, Your Honors. Then we would pray for reversal and acquittal under the first issue, or alternatively, reversal and remand under the other issues on our brief. Thank you.
Thank you both very much.
All rise. The Honorable Court of Appeals.